Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 16th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Amy Plantinga Powell. Session number is 98-7 and is titled Dying Well. Let's listen in.
How, and the session for this evening is called Dying Well. This is one of the chapters in this book, Practicing Our Faith. That's the theme book for Holden this summer. And it's the chapter I wrote for that book. And so I'm delighted you're all here. And I think it's a very important subject. You may be wondering about the title. Isn't that a kind of oxymoron, dying well? Isn't dying a bad thing? And how can you die well? And it's actually been, from the very beginning of Christian history, of great concern to followers of Jesus Christ. Concern not only to live well before God and before each other, but also to die well. Almost right away, Christians experienced a lot of persecution. They experienced martyrdom. And the question about how you died became very important. Dying is, of course, a universal phenomenon. It's not only Christians who die. And every culture and every religious tradition has had to come up with some ways of thinking about it, some ways of marking the passing of a particular life, some way of lifting up the memory of people who have died. I think in many ways, though, it has gotten harder in our culture than it has been. If you think about the way a relative in your family, maybe four or five generations ago, died, it might very well be something like this. They got sick, they died at home, their body was taken to the church, there was a funeral, and their body was buried in the churchyard in back, right? If you have a relative who dies now, chances are, I don't know what the percentage is, that person will die in the hospital, sometimes in ICU, intensive care. Their body will be taken directly from the hospital to a funeral home. There will be a memorial service, perhaps at the funeral home, in the funeral chapel. And their body will be taken by the funeral home to a cemetery somewhere far away from any congregation they may have been part of. There's been a kind of dislocation from the experience of death. That's different for people in this country who live in small towns where the communities are often closer and death becomes a kind of a community affair. It's different for people who live in the inner city where death is often something that's very close to them and they see right outside their window or right down the block. But for many Americans who live in the suburbs, for example, death is primarily something you read about in the newspaper, in the obituary column, or if it's a murder, maybe on the front page. We've gotten separated from it. Many of us live much further away from the basic realities of death and dying than other people in past times and other cultures have. And so part of what we need to do when thinking about the practice of dying well is to think about it as a communal practice. It has become very individualized in our culture. Dying is something you do by yourself often. And if there was one point I was trying to make in this chapter, it's that we have to help each other die well. This is not a kind of individual moral achievement. This is something we need to do together. And my own death is something I spend my life preparing for, by the way I join in the practices surrounding death and dying in my Christian community. I have 3 young children. I hope they're not going to die for another 80 or 90 years. But they are already entering into the practice of dying well. Every time someone in our congregation is sick, every time someone in our congregation dies, they are involved. They are part of the community's response, both to the one who is dying and to the loved ones who are left behind following a death. So they are already participating in the practice of dying well. And I think that communal element is absolutely crucial if we're going to make this practice viable in our own time. Most of the dying and death in our country has been handled for us by 2 very vital and powerful institutions, and that is the medical institution and the funeral home. And I think that obviously there is a lot of good things to be said about both these establishments, the medical establishment and the funeral home. There are also, I think, at some times, points of conflict between the Christian practice of dying well and these 2 powerful establishments. I read a book by Sherman Newland called How We Die a couple years ago. He is a surgeon who has seen many people die, and he worries about something he calls the rescue credo of modern medicine. The idea that death is always a failure on the part of technology, a failure on the part of medical personnel, and so that death must be avoided at all costs, and that biological life of whatever form must be preserved at often great cost, financial cost, emotional cost, etc. And he is worried about that. Now, he is not writing from an avowedly Christian perspective, but he sees it in his own medical practice, the kind of relentless pressure that he feels from his peers, for example, not to let someone die. If there's any way that a life can be preserved in almost any form, that rescue credo, he says, comes in. And he is worried that it sometimes crowds out the possibility of caring for the dying. I think that is something Christians ought to care about. Biological life is of great value. It's a wonderful blessing from God. It's something we're grateful for. But it is not for us the highest good, the thing that trumps everything else. And so there may be times when we need to stop trying to rescue someone from death and start caring for someone who is dying. Many of you, I'm sure, know of the hospice movement, which I think is a wonderful example of this. When the acknowledgement is made of a terminal illness, of a very short lifespan, the idea that you provide medical care to relieve pain, but not to cure, and that you give the dying person time to be home with loved ones, time to sort out their life, time to think about the meaning of important things, rather than keeping them in the hospital surrounded by tubes and machines. There are obviously many difficult cases when it's hard to know what the best thing to do is, hard to know what the life expectancy of a particular person is. But I think the Christian practice of dying well is always concerned at some point to realize that it's someone's time to die, Gilbert Mylander. I'll write his name on the board because it's so hard to spell. He is an ethicist at Valparaiso University, a Lutheran ethicist. And he uses an image that I like very much. He says, when you think of a dinner party, a good host never pushes the guest out of the door before he or she is ready to go, right? That would be very rude to say, oh, I have lots of dishes to do and I'm getting tired. Won't you please go home now? So the good host never pushes the guest out of the door. On the other hand, the good host never forces the guest to stay. The good host recognizes that at some point every good party comes to an end. It's time for everybody to go home. And you don't insist that your guests take another piece of pie or another beer or another cup of coffee. You recognize that the evening has come to an end. Well, says Mylander, there's something like that true about a human life. You don't push someone out of this life before they're ready to go. But on the other hand, you recognize at some point that a life is over and that it's appropriate to let that person go. And you don't try to force them to stay by unreasonable means. Well, what about funeral homes? Sure, you've all been to one, many. And some of you know the kind of disorientation that can happen when the funeral service is held in the chapel of one of these funeral homes. Often looks nothing like the church that the dead person may have been active in. Usually doesn't have anything to sing from, right? No hymn books, and so it's very difficult for the congregation to join in. But funeral homes have turned to great financial advantage a huge cultural void. Namely, when someone dies, there must be ways to honor that person, to remember them, and to comfort those who are grieving. And funeral homes have played that role and continue to play that role for many people. And I don't want to dismiss them. I worry about some of their advertising tactics, and I worry about some of their sales and marketing tactics. But I think they're here to stay in our culture. I also want to say, though, that the Christian church is a community of comfort and a community of memory that the funeral home can never match. And so the funeral home is not a replacement for what the Christian community can do to surround the family of the deceased and to honor and remember the person who died. In my church, what we do every year is put a great big bucket of carnations up in front, and we let everyone who has lost someone dear to them in the past year have a chance to come up and take one of the carnations and put it in a great big vase on the communion table. That means an awful lot to people. The chance to remember in a public and ritual way someone who is important to them. And it also means something to people in our congregation who are facing their own death, to know that when they are gone, the community is going to celebrate their life, and the community is going to remember them long after their workplace and their neighborhood and much less the funeral home has forgotten about them. The church is a kind of unique community of memory in that way. Now, I want to talk about four elements in an understanding of dying well that I think are at its core, and I put them on the board behind me. Lament and thanksgiving and judgment and mercy. And I'm going to start with lament, because I think that's one we sometimes skip over. And I'm going to read to you from Psalm 88, which is one of the lament psalms in the Bible. And you're welcome to open up and read along, Psalm 88. Psalm 88 is really an unrelieved lament psalm. Sometimes lament psalms start out pretty sad, but then have a kind of upturn at the very end, right? But Psalm 88 ends in the pit. O Lord God of my salvation, when at night I cry in your presence, let my cry come before you. Incline your ear to my cry. For my soul is full of troubles, and my life draws near to Sheol. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like those who have no help, like those forsaken among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand. You have put me in the depths of the pit, in the regions dark and deep. Your wrath lies heavy upon me, and you overwhelm me with all your waves. You have caused my companions to shun me. You've made me a thing of horror to them. I am shut in so that I cannot escape. My eye grows dim through sorrow. Every day I call on you, O Lord. I spread out my hands to you. Do you work wonders for the dead? Do the shades rise up and to praise you? Is your steadfast love declared in the grave, or your faithfulness in Abaddon? Are your wonders known in the darkness, or your saving help in the land of forgetfulness? But I, O Lord, cry out to you. In the morning my prayer comes before you. O Lord, why do you cast me off? Why do you hide your face from me? Wretched and close to death from my youth up, I suffer your terrors. I am desperate. Your wrath has swept over me. Your dread assaults destroy me. They surround me like a flood all day long. From all sides they close in on me. You have caused friend and neighbor to shun me. My companions are in darkness. Amen. What kind of prayer is that? I'm from the Presbyterian tradition, and so I always go to John Calvin when I want to think about how my tradition has begun to understand parts of the scripture like this. And John Calvin had a terrible time with psalms like this. And you know, maybe he had some Norwegian in him. So maybe that's also true for the Lutheran tradition. John Calvin loved the Book of Psalms. He wrote a 5-volume commentary on the Book of Psalms. But by the time he wrote that commentary, he had already formulated pretty clearly in his own mind what the proper Christian rules for praying were. And this kind of psalm just doesn't fit. This, he thought, was not a very good model prayer for Christians. He would not encourage people in his own congregation to pray like this. Psalms like this, says Calvin, savor of intemperance. They're not reverent. They don't submit the prayer to God's will. They're not penitent. They don't ask for forgiveness. They get angry with God. They ask God where God is and why God's taking so long and don't you hear me, God? Aren't you paying attention to me? They are not reverent. They're not careful. They're not willing always to trust God's goodness to them. Now, I want us to think for a minute how we think about these psalms and what we think they're doing in the Bible. Why put a psalm like this in the Bible that seems to be, as Calvin saw, so full of anger and despair and impatience and grief? why put something like that in the scripture? Why put this in the community's book? You know, shouldn't the editors have watched this one a little more closely? I mean, surely there were other psalms around they could have put in. Why do you think a psalm like Psalm 88 is in the Bible?
Because that's how we really feel. It's a normal reaction.
It's how we feel. It's a normal reaction. Death evokes strong emotions, right? Fear and anger and worry and despair. So this is an example of how believers in God really do pray, right? Okay. Other ideas about this psalm. Why is it so despairing? Why is it so desperate? Why is it such a lament?
I was going to say because the person feels cut off from God.
Yeah, the sense that God is absent, right? That they're suffering and God seems so far away.
Yeah. In our church, we just studied the Psalms, and one of the comments that one of the parishioners made was, when his son died, this was the only psalm that brought him comfort because of what we've said. This is exactly how he felt. And the other psalms that have a joyful ending, they didn't speak to him at that time.
Right.
This one did.
Yeah. I think that's right, that this psalm speaks to the way people of faith feel in the face of death. That this psalm is an example of faith in God. It doesn't show lack of faith. It's precisely to God that the psalmist brings these feelings in all their intensity and trusts that God can take it, right? That you can be candid, you can be honest with God about how much death hurts, how much fear and despair and grief there is around death. And I think that perhaps for many of us, we were raised in a tradition, maybe influenced by someone like Calvin or Luther, which was a little more reserved about this, and always wanted to kind of put your best face forward in prayer. Maybe hold back some of the grief or the lament that you were feeling, both to God and to members of the community. I was talking to a villager who was here last week, and she said when her husband died, people in her church would ask her, well, how are you doing? And she'd always say, oh, just fine, she said. She said, of course I wasn't feeling just fine. But I felt that they didn't want to hear my lament. And she wasn't quite sure that God wanted to hear her lament either. That it somehow seemed to her as if that might be taken for lack of faith. I put a book up here on the board that I recommend for you. It's in the bookstore. Written by Nicholas Walterstorff, Lament for a Son. His son, Eric Walterstorff, died at the age of 25 in a mountaineering accident. And Nicholas Walterstorff talks about the tragedy of that. And he says that the pain of Eric's death is so acute because he feels that it is a loss not only for the people Eric left behind, his sister and brothers and parents and friends and so on, but he said it is also a loss for Eric. So the lament is both Nicholas Walterstorff's lament for his son, the loss he feels, but it is also a lament that his son missed out on so much. And I think that is part of the reason lament is so appropriate for the practice of dying well. We believe that life on this earth is a great blessing. It's a great gift. And when life is cut short, particularly in a tragic way, there is a great sense of loss. Walter Storff thinks about all the things his son will never do. He'll never get married. He'll never finish his schooling. He'll never have a career. He'll never travel to parts of the world he wanted to see. He'll never enjoy another beautiful New England autumn. All these things he's going to miss out on because of his early death. And Walter Storff laments that, and he says he thinks that is appropriate. If we truly believe that created life is a good, then death is something to be sad about. Death is something to lament. And whatever hopes we may have as Christians for life with God after death, that does not destroy the sadness and the grief and the loss of death. And so there needs to be a way to express that lament, to have it be an expected and an acceptable part of the Christian practice of dying well. Now you notice that the four pieces of this practice that I put on the board kind of fit together in two little pairs. Lament is paired with thanksgiving, and judgment is paired with mercy. And you notice that those pairings are sort of in tension with each other, right? They go together, but they're kind of opposed to each other, in tension with each other. And so I want to move on now and talk about thanksgiving. And if you've been to Christian funerals, you know that often they are called a celebration of the resurrection, right? Or a celebration of the life of so-and-so. There's always an element of thanksgiving at a funeral as well. And early Christians were very intent about that. They would hold their funeral processions outside, and they'd wave branches, and they'd wear white robes, which was for them the color of the resurrection. And there was a kind of public display of thanksgiving, that the person who had endured death in whatever form, through whatever suffering, was now free from that, was now enjoying life with God, and that the promise of their faith was that Christ's resurrection was a kind of first fruits for them, so that the end of earthly life was not simply the end of life for them. Now that part of Christian funerals is probably pretty familiar to you, right? The kind of thanksgiving element. And I think that absolutely has to be part of the practice of thanksgiving, of dying well. But I think we need to let the lament and the thanksgiving work together. I don't think this is a sort of step one and step two kind of process. Okay, get your lament over with, and now we're going to do thanksgiving. I think the two are very intertwined, and we may feel a little of both for a long time. We may be thankful for someone's life, thankful that their suffering is over, thankful that we have a promise of life with God even after our earthly life is over. But that may be all intermingled with this deep sense of lament. And those will often, I think, kind of stay together and are not easily separable. Okay, let's think for a minute about judgment and mercy. Now, judgment, I think, is one of the integral pieces of the Christian practice of dying well, but I also think it's the piece that the Christian community has botched the worst. We have not handled that part of the practice of dying very well. There's been a lot of fear-mongering. there's been a lot of, I think, very, very unnecessary kind of anxiety on the part of the family of the deceased. Judgment, I think, is part of dying well. It's also part of living well. It's not only associated with death. If we live in the Christian community, we come face to face with God's judgment every time we pray, every time we go to church and confess our sins. There is the sense that all is not right with us. We mess up, and we hurt other people, and we distance ourselves from God's love. And if that's true of our life, that's also going to be true of our death, right? We're going to struggle with those same kind of issues around our death. But death often brings with it a kind of urgency, right? We may know while we're still alive and well that we really should seek reconciliation with that particular relative or that particular neighbor. We know that we should confess things we've done against our neighbor or against God. But when death draws near, that sense of judgment can become very strong, and there can be a kind of urgency for setting our affairs in order, doing things right, getting things straight with the people who matter to us. And I think it's appropriate for us to support someone who's dying in that process to the extent we can. I don't think it's our job to judge a dying person. And we've often made that part of our job, I think. We judge whether they were a good Christian or not. We judge whether their faith held out strong to the very end. We judge about, you know, where they're going to end up after they die and all that. I don't think that's our job. I really don't. I think that there are ways in which we have to be willing to help people facing death to try to sort out what their life means, what their life is all about, to settle their accounts as best we can. But I don't think that we have an active role to play in the judgment process. I think that role belongs to God. And I think that we must never set ourselves up as more benevolent than God. To say, well, you know, I really love that person, but I think God's going to send her to hell. You know, that's bad theology. Don't do it. I think we have to trust that just as God's mercy accompanied us in life, it's going to accompany us in death. And I think that the part of the judgment and the mercy process that we must be most active in comes in the assurance of God's mercy. At the end of my chapter, I use the example of infant baptism and say that the beginning of life, for those of you in infant baptism traditions, is kind of like the end. At the beginning of life, we're so weak and so dependent that we can't claim God's promises for ourselves. We can't even walk up to the front of the church on our own, right? Someone carries us up there, and they give us the sign of God's love, the sign of our belonging in this community. Other people, stronger people, older people, wiser people, claim God's promises on our behalf. Right, we're up there red in the face and crying and no clue what's going on, right? And then the rest of the community embraces us and embraces us as a symbol of God's embrace, right? I think the same thing happens at the end of our life. We may well die a pretty nasty biological death. We have no idea, right? But it may well not be pretty, right? We may not die gracefully in our beds surrounded by our friends. That would be great, but who knows? And often the last years or the last months or the last weeks or days of our life are times when we're very weak and we're very vulnerable and we're as helpless as that little infant being brought up for baptism. I think in the same way we need to claim God's promises for the people who are dying. Whether their faith is weak or strong to the end, I think matters very little. But what matters is that the community is there to reaffirm God's promises to them, to reaffirm God's mercy, and to find tangible and concrete ways to do that. Many Protestants have begun to borrow the Catholic practice of anointing with oil. That is a way that a dying person whose mind may be too fuzzy or too confused, you know, to be able to understand Luther's Shorter Catechism or, you know, something else you might want to read to them, may find great comfort in a physical sign that assures them of God's mercy. Singing is another way. You can often comfort a person by singing because those songs and those melodies have become so much part of them. So I think the community does have a very active role to play in extending a sense of God's mercy to those who are dying. What are some of your stories and what are some of your difficulties around the practice of dying well? Where do you have questions or uncertainties or stories of triumph? Some people have wonderful stories of people they know who died supported and nurtured and loved by the community of faith. But I'd like to hear some of them and also to answer some of your questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
I have a friend who works as a nurse in hospice, and she said often she sees the way people die depends on how much they've dealt with their issues in their lives. And if they've done it well, the death goes well. If they still have issues, it's almost painful or very difficult. And people will sometimes hang on and live when they shouldn't even be alive. It's just like there's still something they need to do.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your experience with that.
Yeah. Well, I think the soul and the body are very connected. And I think there are often emotional bonds or other things that affect how people die in a physical way. And I do think that people often do really crave reconciliation and peace when they die. And it may well be, you know, that people sort of cling to life until they feel they have that kind of reconciliation.
I think on that same vein, it's not always the person that's dying, but it's the people around.
Yeah.
In hospital settings, so many times, you see the person that's ready to die, the family is not ready to let them go, and particularly if they have not reconciled with that person.
Yes.
Those are the ones that say, put them on the vent, keep them alive. I'm not ready to let them go.
Right.
The person's ready and wants to go.
Right.
And in that same thing, I've been privileged to be a part of the end of some people's lives in a very beautiful way. I think there are so many wonderful stories that can be told and so many things that other people have told me about their experiences. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing I would impart to a lot of people is that so many people need permission to die.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if it's from their loved one, from a nurse, from a bystander in an accident. Somebody may be hanging on from sheer not knowing whether they can go or not. Sometimes all you need to say is, it's okay, you can let go. I think in the movie we saw last night, Lorenzo's Oil, was a good example, where the mother told the child that it was okay. The child did not die then. But so many times that's what people are waiting for. I've heard older people who say that the traditional practice is to not call a loved one by name or by a term like father, mother, as they're on their deathbed, because they feel it's a call back to life. That one should not address them directly in that way, but to let them go.
Huh. That's interesting.
Your comments about caring for dying people, like the same analogous to infant care, infant baptism, really, I think is very true. And it seems to me that so often it takes a long time for people to die. Mm-hmm. You don't know when they're going to die.
Right.
And very often they're helpless.
Right.
They may not be able to communicate with others during that time.
Yeah.
And so the practical problem is, how do you carry out these practices when you don't know how long?
Right.
Hours,
right.
Days, weeks?
Yeah, months,
And it's so common, I think, for family, much less, say, other church supporters or whatever, to how do you manage the practicalities of just simple day-to-day care, not to mention the presence of being with someone. The child says, how long do I stay away from work and stay here before I go back and care for my family or whatever?
That's right.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, I think that's really true, and it cannot be only the family who's providing that, because they're often stretched out and far flung. There has to be part of a local community that can do it. I think it's also unfortunate, though, that we've our zest for efficiency has even entered the dying and the grieving practices of our culture. I hear about more, sort of weekend funerals. You know, you leave after work on Friday, and you just some slam bang. You know, you get it all done, and you're back to work Monday morning. That's becoming more and more of an American practice. You know, that let's not drag this out. You know, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done, and there can be, I think, a real shortchanging of the practice if sort of efficiency and schedules and everything are allowed to drive it too much. I think are aspects of that practice that stretch out over long periods, even after the death as well as before it. And so it's hard to telescope it in, although it does present real dilemmas for family living far away. Yes.
And I think that's a word to people who employ others. I mean, I am a widow, and I was lucky to work for the Presbyterian Church at the time of my husband's death, and was able to have the amount of time that it took me. Mm-hmm. And I was off work for the better part of a month, both as he was getting ready to die and after his death, and never had to worry about my job, hours, da-da-da-da.
Right.
The other thing I was going to say in relation to that is, both with my husband and with my mother, I found the medical community to be very helpful if you just talk to them.
Yeah.
I mean, they were able to tell me in the death of my mother, who was an Alzheimer's kind of death that dragged out over 13 years. They actually called me the morning that they truly believed mother was finally going to die, and they told me that she would stay awake or stay alive until my brother and sister got there, and I had to get my brother in all the way from California. Mm-hmm. And she did. She did. They had 2 hours together, and she died within an hour.
Wow.
She talked to all of her children. We were all there.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And this was after a long, 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 long journey.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that the medical community, although I think it rightfully deserves the reputation it has in many cases, if you talk to them and tell them what your position is and what you're hoping for and, you know, your opinion about last care, living will kinds of issues, they can be very much in your camp as well as in the position of maybe being perceived as trying to prolong a life that you won't necessarily want.
I mean, my general impression is that the hospitals are more and more open to alternatives like hospice care for terminal patients.
The doctor in the case of my husband was very clear that Hippocratic Oath, that it was his job to try to prolong life. Mm-hmm. And because my husband had a very clear living will leading to the possible donation of organs, he and I had to jockey for a while. But we were able to do it. He out of his Mormon tradition and me out of my Presbyterian tradition. Mm-hmm. And he had come up with rules, sort of his own way of saying, I'm willing to do this, and then I'm willing to say, God has taken over in this life.
Yeah.
It was really some wonderful conversations.
Yeah, that's right.
And he engaged our family, and of course I have a number of minister friends who are surrounding me in this process, mm-hmm. and engaging them in that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was some of the best conversations I've had about this subject.
Yeah.
And so I think it really can be a positive, very positive time.
I also want to make clear that the practice of dying well doesn't hinge upon, you know, whether the doctor's estimate of a life, you know, is right, and so the family all gets there. People die, you know, in car accidents by themselves. They die in prison. They die in war. They die far away from anybody they know. People die in terrible ways. But it is still, I think, the community who lifts up their life and remembers it and celebrates it and comforts those who are left behind and who do those things in any event, you know, no matter how that person died. So I'm not saying that you know, the dying well requires the kind of optimum circumstances, you know, being able to say goodbye to every loved one, because that doesn't always happen. But I think if there is going to be a possibility of dying well, even under terrible circumstances, it has to come from this communal memory and support and nurture that's extended. Others of you, yeah.
Just as a side comment, the nursing community, I think more and more within the nursing community, nurses encourage folks to go against the medical advice. Certainly they are bound by hospital rules and it means just as much as other folks. A nurse in a class that I was taking not long ago mentioned that she was working in the neonatal intensive care unit with a baby that obviously was not going to live, and was the cost of keeping this baby alive day by day was so incredible, and on respirators and sophisticated equipment, and the parents couldn't even touch the child. And given the advice that they should go against medical advice by their pastor and take the baby home, let the baby die in their own arms, was the best thing they could do. Mm-hmm.
I think that's another point when we talk about the medical community. I certainly understand your point that isn't where everyone dies. But I think we sometimes forget the roles everybody plays. And when you look at the doctors, we often look to them for the answers. They don't always have it. When you talk about the doctor writing the book about seeing many people die, my first question is, did he actually see them die? I doubt it. It's the nurses that see the people die. It's the nurses that often are the only ones in the room when someone dies. They're the ones that are a little bit more experienced. They're the ones that see both the family and the patient as the ones they're serving. And sometimes we get hung up on what the doctor says, but we need to also pay attention to the people that are the closest to it, the people that have the most experience. And, you know, in the same terms, like you're talking about waiting for someone to come, sometimes nurses and people who have experienced a lot of death will say, people will often wait until those people go. Sometimes, I was just in with Mother 20 minutes ago and now she's gone. Mother waited for you to go. Go get that cup of coffee.
I've heard those kind of stories. What about the aspect of lament that I started with? Have you felt, and I'll let you ask your question in a minute, have you felt that lament was a kind of accepted and integral part of dying and death? Have there been ways that your community has made it possible to lament, to express that grief and despair? Yes?
No, I think that I've noticed some people prefer to do it in private and not in public. But I don't know where that comes from. Yeah. It just seems that it's not appropriate to show that kind of grief in public.
Yeah. That if you feel grief, it's something you must keep to yourself.
I had an interesting thing happen to me this last winter. My father died, and I was privileged to be present with him, and my brothers were also present there. My sister-in-law pulled me aside and said, "Help your brother cry." Hmm. And so I felt invited to my own tears. Through that, because it was my own weeping and wailing that kind of allowed my brother to do that too, in the sense of, you know, he was also lamenting with me and for me too, for my pain. But it was interesting meditation, because my sister-in-law didn't feel like she could help him cry. She thought, I could, I'm the baby.
That there's something important, as Lisa was saying, about a public expression of grief, that it does not or does not have to be something that is only private.
Along those lines, was my comment, my brother's brother-in-law died of leukemia the past year, and his wife chose only to have the service at the funeral home and not at the church. Because I think, you know, I mean, what my brother said was she just thought it would be too painful for her to, you know, think of that each week she was at the church. And so it's interesting to me to listen to this, and is that a failing of the community in some way?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think people, you know, make those kind of choices for lots of different reasons.
Don't you feel that the church has let a lot of the living down of the family? But I'm thinking of the widows. There seem to be so many widows in our church that don't seem to be served to go through their grieving. There are a club or an organization that they can go to go through the steps of grieving that really seem to help people go, that it's all right to be angry with God. It's something you have to go through. I think we're kind of letting down those that are left. The loved ones. The church just does not fill that void.
So that people show up for the funeral, but then the kind of continuing.
People don't know how to express, are you doing all right? But they don't really want to hear the answer.
Right.
Or they don't even say that much. But to help those people feel that they're still a part of the Christian community and right. that they're loved.
I think that's...
And it's all right that they have a right to miss that person.
Yeah, I think that's all part of the practice and has to be there.
And I think that's one of the really nice things about the community of the church and the funerals. I've heard many people talk about how when they have a loved one die, they go, I don't remember anything anybody said to me, but I remember that they were there.
Yeah, just the act of gathering together is very powerful.
Yes, I wonder if you'd like could comment at all on what I see as the cultural expectation that there is a process, a series of steps, and you go through it, and then you get over it.
I think, with the especially with the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and so on, there have been, it's not really a 12-step program, it's sort of like a 7-step program. And you go through it, and then you're supposed to be, cured or something. I think the experience of many people is that the loss of someone is not something you recover from in kind of easily defined stages. And many people say that they're often surprised by grief, when they think that they really have had a lot of healing. Something else will happen that will trigger in them a memory of that person or a kind of new wave of grief. And so I think for many people, it's not a kind of self-help program they complete and then skip off into the sunset. I mean, I think that for a lot of people, it's kind of unpredictable and often very, very long lasting. Yes?
Just one comment about bringing children into this situation, and that certainly in our experiences with death in our own family, inviting and even encouraging our children to be a part of that process enriched it for everyone.
Yes.
And children learn by observation and imitation, and as well as some adults.
Yeah.
And so being angry or being all those things and really crying or saying, I'm just throwing myself in God's arms now because there's nothing else I can do. Right. Saying those words to a child, this is very important to be real to them.
And I think sometimes our desire to shield children from the reality of death is also a desire to shield ourselves from having to explain those realities to them. and so it's sort of bringing them in then also requires us to think about those issues and be able to talk about them.
I've wondered about that sometimes with my kids because, being a pastor, they've been there when I've gotten the call that so-and-so has committed suicide.
Right.
Or that this person that they've known since they were a baby in this church that they hear me talk about a lot.
Right.
Has died. And after 5 or 6 of these, when they're becoming cognizant of all this, they're at all the funerals, they're really involved in all this, they just say, I don't even know if I like to come to church anymore because everybody I love always dies. So I sometimes wonder about that, about the saturation point of that for young children. That, they've turned out fine so far. But I'm worried about them.
Yeah, particularly for your role
for
as a pastor.
Kids.
You're sort of a minister of this grieving and so on.
There's another side to that if a child loses a parent, which occurred in my life. There's a great void there if you're not allowed, if you're told, or even if it's just insinuated that you shouldn't grieve. And you don't attend the funeral. That carries with you a long time.
I believe that. And I think that was very common, at least in the past, very common, not to let young children go to funerals at all. Yeah, that's right.
I work at a residential school for the deaf, and
and we have a very small community, and we are a large family, and we have people die every year. And up until recently, it was the practice of the school that the children were kept separate from the lamenting, from the Thanksgiving, from the celebration, from the remembering. And this last year, we had a very significant death in our community. And I fortunately was an administrator at the time and worked diligently to educate the students. And all the students who wanted to come to the funeral were empowered and brought. And there was great controversy among the adults in our community that what I had done was horrible.
Yeah.
And what was wonderful after the funeral, people said, well, the children behaved. Well, it wasn't about their behaving. It was about their being able to be part of the letting go, the lifting up, the crying, the Thanksgiving, and the remembering.
Yeah.
That's why they behaved.
Yeah.
And the adults learned something.
Yeah.
But it was a different thing. And it's very true. They have to be allowed.
Yeah. And it's often, as much about the adult's attitude toward death as about whatever the children may do.
I think the concept of, you know, for a young child to understand the concept of dying is difficult enough. And I think what you had mentioned about the remembering beyond, you know, the ceremonial part of it is so important. It's scary enough for a child to lose somebody, they've never seen them again, they've disappeared and swallowed up in a void, and then to feel uncomfortable as a friend or a parent not to talk about that person anymore.
Yes.
That's even scarier.
Oh, yes. Right. Right. So the idea that that person is still present in some way to the community.
So they're not really totally gone, whereas if you don't talk about it, that's certainly, that's what the child is afraid of, is really happening.
Right.
They've disappeared permanently.
Right. They're just gone. Yeah.
I was thinking, other cultures handle, I don't know if they actually handle their grief therapy this way, but every year they have a ritual when they remember the dead, and they, it's actually a ritual. And I'm just wondering now, that is probably very good grief therapy.
Yeah.
And it's just like this handing out the carnation.
Yes, it is a kind of ritualized remembrance.
I think that's very, very important.
Yeah.
Baking a cake on their birthday,
something that's what time of the year do you do that?
We do it on All Saints Day.
Yeah, this is
so we're thinking about that great cloud of witnesses.
Right.
We do it. I think we have time for one more comment.
I was just going to say, for those of you who are going to be here next week, and I'm very sorry. I'm listed with Anne Maria Pineda, and she's going to be talking about both the Day of the Dead and something I don't know, I've never heard of it before, but a 9-day ritual in the Hispanic community. So
surrounding
them, watching that.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.